Welcome, everyone, and thank you for standing by. At this time, I'd like to inform all participants that your lines will be in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference call. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your phone. If you need to withdraw your request, you may press star two. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to our first speaker, Ms. Karen Fox. Thank you. You may begin.
Hello. Welcome to our NASA press conference. I am Karen Fox with NASA Communications. First off, you should know there is imagery and written materials available to go along with this teleconference at nasa.gov/live. That's L-I-V-E after the slash. We are here today to talk about the sun's solar cycle. This is a cycle where the sun moves from a quiet stage, which we call solar minimum, to a much more active stage called solar maximum. And that whole cycle takes on average about 11 years. And one of the ways we track it is by tracking dark sunspots that appear on the sun. You'll be able to see some pictures of that in the imagery shared for the telecon. Again, that's at nasa.gov/live. During the active stages, the sun can also create giant eruptions called solar flares and coronal mass ejections. And these eruptions can create a space weather system around Earth that can affect our technology and astronauts. So we are going to be talking about all of this today and tell you a little bit about what you can expect coming up soon for the solar cycle. We have a panel of speakers for starters. We will take our press questions at the end. Speaking today will be Lisa Upton. She is the co-chair of the Solar Cycle 25 Prediction Panel. She is a solar physicist at Space Systems Research Corporation in Alexandria, Virginia. Next, we have Doug Biesecker, another co-chair of the Solar Cycle 25 Prediction Panel. He's a solar physicist at NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center in Colorado. We have Elsied Talat, the director at the Office of Projects Planning and Analysis for NOAA's Satellite and Information Service. We have Lika Buhatakurta, a heliophysicist in the Heliophysics Division at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. And finally, we have Jake Bleacher. He is the Chief Exploration Scientist at NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate, also at headquarters in Washington, D.C. And with that, I will pass off to Lisa Upton to start us off.
Thank you so much, Karen. We are very excited to be here today to announce that Solar Cycle 25 has officially started. The sunspot number is calculated for each day and each month. However, since the daily monthly sunspot numbers are so variable, we typically measure the sunspot cycle using the 13-month smooth data, which is obtained by averaging the monthly sunspot number over 13 months. The last cycle, Solar Cycle 24, was the fourth smallest cycle on record and the weakest cycle in 100 years, with a 13-month smooth sunspot number of 114. Solar Cycle 24 just came to an end, and Solar Cycle 25 began this past December of 2019. That makes Solar Cycle 24 precisely the average cycle length of 11 years. Like the solar minimum that preceded Solar Cycle 24, the current minimum has been very weak, marked with many spotless days and some months showing almost no sunspots. Because we have to wait to fill in all of the data points to get the 13-month smooth data and to make sure that the sun doesn't have any surprises for us, we usually have to wait about 7 to 10 months after minimum occurs before we can determine the precise timing of solar minimum and the transition from one cycle to next. And make this official announcement. So in December of 2019, the smooth sunspot number reached its weakest point with a smooth sunspot number of 1.8. And since then, it's been slowly but steadily increasing. Each solar cycle has about 11 years, and each solar cycle, NOAA and NASA convene a panel to make an official prediction for the amplitude of the coming cycle. This solar cycle prediction panel must evaluate all of the available predictions and come up with a consensus forecast for the next cycle. Here to tell you about our official prediction for Solar Cycle 25 is the panel's co-chair, Doug Biesecker, and NOAA's from NOAA's Space Weather Prediction Center.
Thank you, Lisa. So coincidentally, also in December of 2019, this NOAA-NASA convened international panel announced that solar cycle 25 will reach a peak sunspot number of 115 in July of 2025. If this turns out to be true, this would make cycle 25 almost identical to the solar cycle 24 Lisa just told you about. As we toward solar maximum, we can expect an increased frequency of solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and other space weather-related activity. Space weather affects a wide range of systems here on Earth, such as the electric power industry, airlines, global positioning systems such as GPS, satellites, rockets, and even emergency managers are very interested in space weather. Here at the NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Colorado, we are the nation's official civilian source of space weather forecasts, watches, warnings, and alerts. To give you some examples of how these industries are impacted by space weather, and these are just examples, the electric power grid can suffer from protective equipment failing, or transformers themselves can fail, which could lead to power blackouts. The most common aircraft impact would be to lose contact with air traffic control due to HF communication being out. GPS users, particularly something known as precision GPS that's used for surveying, drilling, and farming, among other activities, can be degraded or lost temporarily. We serve customers from the industries mentioned as well as many others. The space weather forecasts provided by NOAA help to protect our technology and infrastructure. Even though we are at solar minimum at this time, there is always reason to be wary. At solar minimum, there is still a risk of eruptions from the sun, but also, for example, high-speed solar wind can cause problems for satellites. The NOAA Space Weather Prediction Center is staffed 24/7 because the sun is always capable of sending trouble our way. To ensure space weather forecasts protect our industries and continue to improve, we work closely with our partners at NASA, the National Science Foundation, the Federal Aviation Administration, Homeland Security, and many other agencies. El Sayed Talat, also of NOAA, will tell you more about that.
Thanks, Doug. As you just heard from Doug, of all these space weather effects that can affect our technological infrastructure, we have to be prepared for all types of space weather activity. And just as the National Weather Service makes us a weather-ready nation, they're also driving us to be a space weather-ready nation. And they're leading this, but we're doing this in a cross-government multi-agency effort under the renewed National Space Weather Strategy and Action Plan, which has brought 24 agencies across the government under the leadership from the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy to drive operational and strategic changes in the National Space Weather Program, transforming space weather from a research-focused activity to a national operational priority. So this plan seeks to achieve three objectives: to enhance the protection of national security, homeland security, and commercial assets and operations against the effects of space weather that Doug listed, developing and disseminating accurate and timely space weather characterization and forecasts as being done by the Space Weather Prediction Center, and establishing plans and procedures for responding to and recovering from space weather events. So we've made a lot of progress. Space weather has been incorporated into international, national, and local emergency management exercises. Doug laid out that how we're working with aviation operations and as well as the daily operations for the electric grid, among other stakeholders, including spacecraft operators as well. So we've including in this effort is significant progress and critical observation to support operations and to validate the research that we're doing for space weather. So NOAA is now supporting the operations and maintenance of 6 critical solar observatories and working with NSF to operationalize and make new products with this data. The U.S. Geological Survey is continuing to maintain ground-based magnetometer network and expanding its magnetotelluric survey to be able to predict the geomagnetic effects as they reach to the ground and into our power grid and pipelines. And we've also made significant advances in our observational capability for operation. The GOES geostationary satellites that NOAA uses for weather observations also make observations of the solar conditions as well that we monitor, as Doug said, 24/7. We recently launched with Taiwan the suite of six satellites in the Cosmic 2 mission that give us a now cast opportunity and with data simulation a forecast opportunity of the ionospheric conditions in response to space weather. And we're planning for the launch of the space weather development and launch of the space weather follow-on mission that will give us the upstream measurements that that we need to drive our predictive models for space weather, as well as give us coronal imagery to look at for explosions off the sun, the coronal mass ejections that you heard about. So this we're working to a space weather paradigm that's similar to a terrestrial weather paradigm to address our user needs. And we're building off the successes in the development of research observations and models in the academic and private sector and transitioning those to operations. And I'd like to hand it off to Lika to discuss the exciting research that is being done.
Thank you, Elsayed. As indicated by Doug and Elsayed, the need for accurate forecast of solar cycles and space weather and solar variability cannot be overstated. And NASA's heliophysics division is the research arm of that continuum. Years ago, the study of the Sun-Earth connection was pretty unconventional. Today, as you heard from the previous speakers, NASA, NOAA, and other agencies actually hold our planet and our star, the Sun, to be a connected system. And new ideas emerge from this synthesis, and a new discipline, heliophysics, was born. Like Earth, every world in the solar system is connected to its star, and similarly, every exoplanet is connected to its host exostar. Magnetism describes virtually every feature on the Sun, as you can see on the visual image on 12, from sunspots to the soaring structures you see in SDO images. And these magnetism is very much the fuel that really creates the solar cycle. Now, heliophysics is a new science. It's an environmental science, a hybrid between meteorology and astrophysics. Meteorologically speaking, weather in the Midwest today kind of becomes Washington's weather tomorrow. Similarly, weather on the Sun today becomes space weather in low Earth orbit later this week, depending on the speed of the coronal mass ejection. So over the solar cycle time frame, you know, Sun impacts Earth with variability of magnetic fields, radiation, and particles, which is mass. And they interact differently with different layers of a planetary environment. And the societal impacts range from human radiation, impact on technology, and even terrestrial climate. The next frontier in space weather forecasting involves the uninterrupted tracking of storm clouds from the Sun to the planets. And you can see these visuals on 14 and 15. NASA's stereo spacecraft with enhanced data processing techniques succeeded in tracking space weather events from their origin in the Sun's ultra-hot corona to impact with the Earth 96 million miles away. The 360 view offered by the stereo spacecraft showed that the entire solar system lives with this star. And not just a solar magnetic field, but a planetary magnetic field makes a difference too. If you look at visual 16, at some point, Mars lost its global magnetic field, removing the planet's main source of protection from the solar wind. And as a result, Mars loses about 100 grams of atmosphere every second. This goes up by a factor of 10 to 20 during a solar storm. We are lucky in our division. We have launched some exciting new missions, Harper Solar Probe and Solar Orbiter Collaboration with European Space Agency to really investigate the inner heliosphere. While each mission will achieve its own important science objectives, taken together with the Heliophysics Systems Observatory fleet in Visual 17, these spacecraft will be capable of doing the multi-point observation measurements required to address problems of CME initiation and propagation, transport of energetic particles, and others. In particular, these missions will provide invaluable observations to predict space weather at different locations in the solar system, including Venus flyby locations. And finally, if you take a look at ViewGraph 18, which shows the side-by-side solar cycle, heliophysics research is important during solar max and mean, as shown in this diagram plotted horizontally as opposed to the usual vertical. High sunspot numbers are in red on the right, low sunspot numbers are in blue on the left, and associated with each high and low sunspot numbers are different space weather impacts experienced at Earth. Solar El Niño and solar La Niña are two sides of a great climate oscillation, not on Earth, but on the Sun, and magnetic variability on the Sun controls both extremes of the solar cycle. But at present, we are observing the weakest solar cycle of the past century, as indicated by Lisa. During solar minimum, solar activity does not vanish, it just changes form. Example, galactic cosmic rays are at all-time high in the space environment, and this has all kinds of implications for space exploration, space tourism, and aviation industry. And I'll pass on to Jay to talk more about NASA's plan of space exploration and the Artemis program.
Thank you, Ika. As everyone has just heard, we've talked about the solar cycle, space weather, how we measure the sun and its impact on the Earth, and how we protect ourselves here on and around the Earth. But in addition to that, NASA cares about protecting our assets in deep space. This is an exciting time for human exploration because we're preparing to move our astronauts beyond low Earth orbit through our Artemis program, which will enable them to land in the south polar region of the moon. Now, a trip to the moon can include periods of time when our astronauts will not be protected from space weather by the Earth's magnetic field. So as we make these trips to the moon, it's critical for us to understand what the environment will be like. What are the weather conditions we should expect to experience? Understanding and expecting what's coming for us helps us to ensure the success of our trip, the safety of our astronauts, and the continued operation of our hardware. Just like here at home, when you go on a trip anywhere, you're going to check the weather report, right? You need to know what to expect. Do you bring your rain jacket, a heavy parka, are you bringing swimwear? That depends on the weather you expect to experience. If you don't know what weather you're experiencing, you have to prepare with even more of the type of gear just to be ready for it. Well, it's the same when you're taking a trip out into deep space, to the moon, onto Mars, anywhere. So on the human exploration side of things, we really depend on the types of science that our colleagues are talking about here, the work from NOAA, from NASA, and elsewhere, that's critical for helping us understand the conditions that our astronauts are going to experience. We like to say that human exploration and science go hand in hand. Well, to this endeavor, human exploration is trying to help. One of the first spacecraft that we will put in orbit for Artemis is the Gateway. The Gateway is a platform that will orbit the moon. It will be a destination where our astronauts can go to. There's a habitable volume, and from there they can land on the surface of the moon. Well, that will be in place. The Gateway will be in place well before our astronauts are getting to the moon. So we'll have time to make some measurements and conduct some research there. The first two payloads that we have linked with the Gateway will be measuring space weather and heliophysics conditions from the Gateway orbit, which is where we expect our crews to be. So we're trying to help add to the fleet of spacecraft that are measuring the sun and understanding this environment. One of the things I like to say as well is that what's key to traveling through space is being able to predict, prepare, and mitigate. We need to expect what's coming by predicting it. Once we know it's on its way, we need to be prepared for it. We need to have the right hardware. And the mitigate part is being able to design our hardware in our systems so that we can protect our astronauts, protect our hardware. So again, our exploration and our science go hand in hand as we explore the solar system. What's key is that by challenging ourselves with these exciting exploration goals, we will have to use science to help develop techniques and technologies to help us mitigate those risks. Those critical technologies and techniques will subsequently become infused in the way that we protect ourselves here on the Earth. So with that, I think we're ready for questions, Karen, if you'd like to take over.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jake. Thank you, everybody. We are going to hand back to our operator again to remind everybody how to ask questions. But go ahead and sign up, and we will be here to keep answering questions.
Thank you. Again, at this time, if there are questions or comments, please press star 1 on your phone. If you need to withdraw your request, you can press star 2. And once again, it is star 1 if you have any questions or comments. Just one moment while we get our first question. First question will be from Russell Pounds of Pacific Rim Media. Your line is open.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for doing this. This is Russell calling from Alaska today. And a question for Jake. I was intrigued about the kinds of things you were reviewing there in your presentation. And could you tell me what are some of the things that might surprise most Americans about what you've learned most recently with this research and preparing for the Gateway Project and so forth? Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Russell. That's a very good question. I think one thing that I like to bring up that maybe most people don't know about is that in order to prepare for long trips in deep space, not only do we need to think about what radiation and the space weather environment does to our hardware and our electronics and our astronauts, we also have to consider things, for instance, like our pharmaceuticals, the drugs that our astronauts might need to take, or the food. We need to understand whether or not that space weather environment has an impact on the efficiency of those materials. So that goes into planning, you know, if you want to take some medicine along to help with pain or headaches or things like that, we need to know that the right amount is going along, that we can depend on it, and the same with food. So the Gateway is another place where we can do tests like that. We can basically put materials up there and look at how they react to that environment. So not only can we look at how they react, we have to accurately characterize what that environment is. And so the Gateway is a perfect platform for us to conduct these types of research studies.
Well, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next response will be from Kenneth Chang of New York Times. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. This question, I guess, is mainly for Doug, because I remember talking about similar things 11, 12 years ago. And the question is, are you getting better at these solar cycle forecasts? How good were the forecasts for solar cycle 24? What did you learn about what works and what doesn't work at these forecasts? And how much confidence do you have in this upcoming forecast, given that the individual forecasts range from it getting even weaker to rebounding to almost higher levels?
Right. So thank you, Ken. And I'll want Lisa to chime in after me. But as regards to the Cycle 24 forecast, the numbers I remember, of course, are in an old version of the sunspot number, so I'm not going to quote them. But we were very close in predicting solar cycle 24. It was within what we considered to be our error bar of a sunspot number of plus or minus 10. We did get the timing of maximum wrong, and the reason for that was because we treated the sun as one big ball of gas. But the hemispheres, the south and the north, behave independently. And the last solar cycle, they were out of phase with each other more so than ever before, which sort of ruined our forecast a bit. But what was absolutely true was by monitoring the magnetic fields in the polar regions of the sun, that has consistently given us the best forecast of the next solar cycle for the last 4 to 5 cycles. And that is still considered to be, by the people that do the solar cycle modeling, to be the best way to predict the next solar cycle. And so based on the strength of the polar fields at solar minimum, we believe solar cycle 25 will be similar intensity to solar cycle 24. This happens to be an area where LISA specializes in that research.
Absolutely. Thanks, Doug. Yeah, so we've gotten very good at modeling the evolution of the polar magnetic fields. And as Doug mentioned, this is one of the best indicators for the amplitude of the coming cycles. And was one of the main features that the prediction panel looked at to make our consensus forecast for solar cycle 25. That being said, there's other indicators that have since come about that we can look at as kind of a reassurance that we're well on the way, on the right track for our prediction for solar cycle 25. One of the things that we can look at is the amount of spotless days that occur. And if you compare this minimum with the minimum that we had before solar cycle 24, you find that both of those cycles had very long periods of spotless days that occurred. And so this is an indicator that we should expect another weak cycle. Another thing that you can look at is the few active regions, the solar cycle 25 active regions that have already begun to emerge are emerging at lower latitudes than they typically emerge for stronger cycles. So when you have a weak cycle, the latitudes where the active regions emerge are a little bit lower than the active regions that emerge when you have a very strong cycle. And so since we're seeing these active regions emerging at lower latitudes, that's yet another indicator that we should expect a weak cycle. But one of the best things that we can continue to look at as we move forward, as this cycle begins to progress, is how quickly the cycle ramps up. So if we watch the sunspot number in the coming months, and if we see that the cycle is ramping up slowly, then that's another indicator, yet again, that we're well on the right track for our prediction for solar cycle 25. If, however, it comes up and it starts to ramp up very quickly, then we might expect that the cycle will be a little bit stronger than we predicted.
May I add to this?
Sure.
So I'd also like to talk a little bit about future. So sunspots, as we know, is not sort of a physical quantity. It is, showing region of magnetic field strength and darkness because there is a lower amount of heat propagating there. So Doug mentioned polar field strength. Doug and Lisa, so we actually have a new mission concept that has been selected to really get that polar field strength down accurately. I cannot overemphasize how important that is. But for future, I think we will also be looking at using the modern tools of mathematics, deep learning, machine learning, to really put the data we have collected over many decades to kind of try to pull out inference patterns of solar cycles as well.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons why it's such an exciting time to be in the field of solar physics. We're seeing advances just so regularly thanks to the support of NASA and NOAA and all of the NSF and all the other agencies that are helping to support this research.
Thank you. Our next response will be from Megan Bartel, space.com. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you all so much for taking my call. I wanted to ask more about the mission's impact on particularly the solar cycle 25 prediction, given that Cosmic 2 launched about a year ago and Parker Solar Probe about 2 years ago. I was curious to what extent the data from those actually impacted the solar cycle 25 prediction versus sort of is going in the can for analyzing solar cycle 25 itself and looking ahead to the next one. Thanks.
So this is Doug. I think I'll start. Yeah, so And Lika partially addressed this, right? Rework with sunspot number. And actually, recent work on sunspot number, the sunspot number historical record was recently revised about 5 years ago. It now correlates much more strongly with the measures of activity like solar flares and with the radio flux observed from the sun. So, in fact, there's reason to keep predicting sunspot number as a result of recent work. But, you know, when we're trying to predict something that's got an 11-year cycle, new data is always useful, but is hard to trust in terms of, well, what does that mean? I have one or two data points. Can I take that and extrapolate for what that will mean for the next 5 or 6 years? So in general, no, the newer missions have not yet played a role in the process of predicting the cycle, but that doesn't mean that they won't play a role when we come around to trying to predict solar cycle 26.
Got it. Thank you.
I think that's particularly true when it comes to measuring the polar magnetic fields. You know, all of our measurements currently of the polar magnetic fields have been from the Earth line of sight. And so as we have new missions and some of these new missions are going to higher and higher latitudes, we're have the opportunity to explore regions of the sun that really haven't been explored. And so I think that's really exciting in terms of solar cycle prediction in that it will give us a much better understanding of how the solar cycle will progress and that relationship between the sun's magnetic polar magnetic fields and the solar cycle progression.
But I think sunspot numbers are used really because of historical reasons, because we don't have an index that goes as far back as sunspot numbers do. But the missions you are talking about, Parker Solar Probe or Solar Orbiter Collaboration, they are in the inner heliosphere, not in one spot at any one time. What they are going to give us, actually, in future, which will be folded into probably a larger version of solar cycle prediction, is they are going to actually tell us about the NOAA R scale, which is, you know, the corona is hot and controlled by the magnetic field, and it generates X-rays and extreme ultraviolet variability at Earth. So that's kind of one signal. The other is high-speed solar wind that originates from coronal holes or, you know, CME-CME interaction that produces shocks, and that's the NOAA S scale. And these are areas, you know, we don't break it down into these scales, but these are very important to keep in mind because they impact different areas differently. And finally, of course, you know, the one that we are most familiar with is the NOAA G scale, which is where mass from the corona is ejected into interplanetary space. So if you think about breaking down and parsing exactly what we need to have an understanding of solar cycle so that we can inform each category of user community that are utilizing these particular kinds of measurements.
Mm. Great, thank you.
Thank you. Our next response will be from Alexandria Witsa of Nature Magazine. Your line is open.
Great. Thank you. My question is for Dr. Talat, and it's about future space weather monitoring. So some of the instruments, some of the spacecraft out there are getting old, and you referenced the space weather follow-on mission that's being developed. So the Europeans have planning on sending their space weather mission to L1. No, the space weather follow-on from the U.S. will go to L1, but it won't have a coronagraph, which the coronagraph is going to be on the weather satellite going around Earth, which will make it less able to do its job. Can you just talk a little bit about how we got to that point where our next space weather monitoring mission is kind of decoupled into these two parts instead of being a coherent, integrated whole?
Actually, I'd like to update you on both our plans and then the European Space Agency plans as well. So the space weather follow-on mission, which is going to L1, as you mentioned, will have a suite of in-situ space weather measurements, solar wind instrumentation, but it will also have a compact coronagraph on board as well. So it will provide both continuity for Discover and ACE for the upstream solar wind measurements, as well as for SOHO to make the chronograph measurements that's needed for our long-term predictions of space weather activity. We are also, as you stated, manifesting a compact chronograph on our next geostationary satellite, GOES-U, or on a next geostationary satellite, GOES-U, which is going to launch in 2024. A space weather follow-on is also going to launch in 2024 as a rideshare with the NASA IMAP mission. So that other chronograph will provide us resiliency in our observations, so that we're not single string anymore in the chronograph measurements. And then with ESA, we're working with them closely and coordinating what we're doing with what they're doing. And in fact, they are planning to send their mission to L5, which gives us off-axis coverage of the sun and the solar wind. So it's 60 degrees away from Earth along the 1AU, one astronomical unit, along the Earth's orbit, trailing Earth. And then those measurements we will use to give us a stereo view of any coronal mass ejections off the sun, and also earlier warning of different impending active regions on the sun. So we're working closely with ESA on planning for data sharing, and also possible instrument collaboration with us providing a compact chronograph, and they're providing a X-ray monitor for our space weather follow-on mission at L1.
Great. Thanks. That was going off old information. Thanks for the updates.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Our next response will be from Irene Klotz of Aviation Week. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. My question is for Doug. Nice to hear your voice. If memory serves, the panel for the Solar Cycle 24 prediction didn't get to consensus when you initially announced the prediction, and later on everybody kind of did gather around and once more time had passed and you could see what was happening. So the question is, and I believe there was some debate about different techniques, like how much to weigh one methodology versus another. So the question is, how much of a consensus was this group for the cycle 25, and what technique, aside from what you've already described as the strength of the magnetic poles, is playing a role? And then just for comparison's sake, what's a very active solar cycle as far as the number of sunspots compared to the 115 that you said for 25? Thanks.
Okay, thanks, and it's great to hear from you, and actually many of you that I've interacted with over the years. So first, let's try to guess what a very active cycle would be, and that would be above average. And in the new sunspot numbering, that would be, I would say, 200 and above. So about half of that is where we are. Now, about the controversies of last time, yes, they existed. We were very public about that. We wanted the community to know why we were having trouble achieving consensus. And the new sort of model that was giving us cause to question, you know, whether the magnetic field models that we'd relied on in the past might not be the best was what we called a mean field dynamo model. And these were relatively new at the time, so there were a lot of question marks about them. In the time that's happened since then, the folks that do that kind of modeling have learned a lot. And, in fact, we mentioned the polar fields. Well, there's three different ways people use the magnetic field information that this panel relied on. Those were the dynamo models, the polar field techniques that were directly used by the last panel, but also Lisa, I've forgotten the exact name to call it, the meridional flow models.
Surface flow transport model?
Sorry, say that again.
Aft surface flux transport model?
Yeah, the flux transport models, surface flux transport models, which then are a way of trying to predict farther in advance what the polar fields will look like. The one thing, and this is I would argue the concern of any forecaster is that the panel came to agreement pretty quickly, and the consensus was very solid. And so one always worries, did that mean that we didn't do our homework? Is there something we overlooked because there wasn't this controversy? We did spend a lot of time doing our homework. We took an extra 6 months digging deeper to make sure that we hadn't missed anything. So I think it's you know, there's always that nagging doubt with any forecast, but no, in this case, the panel achieved consensus fairly quickly.
Thank you.
I think I would just add to that, you know, the models that we have the most confidence in, as Doug mentioned, the dynamo models, looking at the precursors, the polar field precursors, geomagnetic precursors, surface flux transport models, all of those types of models that are very physics-based have really evolved significantly in the last decade since the last cycle, and all of those models tended to fit very nicely in line with our prediction. And so I think it was a little bit easier for the panel this time to come to that consensus because there was so much agreement in those very reliable physics-based methods.
All right, thank you. Our next response will be from Susan Wood of North Bay Business Journal. Your line is open.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for gathering. forgive me, I have a number of questions because I rarely get this kind of brain trust in one place. So I'd like to pare this down to this atmospheric subject down to local jurisdictions and what this means, because being in the North San Francisco Bay coverage area, of course, you could probably expect that citizens and local governments are thinking, well, you know, what do we need next, locusts? But, of course, I didn't go to solar activity, so here we go. What I'm wondering about is what you would say. Okay, so I can give you my email address if someone wants to tackle a list of questions. But I'd like to start with my primary ones are how can a person, a business, or a local government in, say, a power grid vulnerable area alleviate any kind of problems that are going to be associated with, say, solar flares? And then I'd also like, I'm glad Lisa brought up, you know, what constitutes an active cycle, because I'd also like to pare this down to what's an example of an event or a year that people can relate to as an example of an active cycle. And then I'd also like to know, since I am a bit of a weather junkie, what effects, does your data show any kind of effect on the weather itself on our planet, or even in regions of our planet, from any kind of solar outbursts? And I'd also like, I hope someone's tracking these questions, are the cycles shorter at 11 years? I'd also like to know how you would describe the solar minimum and how you know what a minimum is. And what is, I'm really sorry, but, you know.
So, hey, actually, Susan, why don't I think you do have so many good
about
questions.
This cycle?
Susan, since you do have so many good questions, I think you're right. It would be a good idea if we could take some of them by email. My name is Karen Fox, and my email address is at the bottom of that release at nasa.gov. live, or I can send you an email and just get, we can get all of these answered for you. But I would like to answer at least one of your questions, and you started out with some questions about this solar cycle, and if you want to reiterate that in here.
Yeah. So, okay, and this is Karen, correct?
Yep.
Okay. Okay, Karen, I'll email you. So what I'd really like to know right off the bat to pare this down is, what would you tell people, businesses, and local governments in power grid vulnerable areas, how they could alleviate any kind of problems? I realize this is not this panel's job, per se, but anecdotally, how could any of these problems associated with, say, solar outbursts be alleviated?
Actually, that's Doug Biesecker's precise job, if Doug wants to take that question.
Oh, okay.
Right. So this is Doug Biesecker at the Space Weather Prediction Center. And right, it's a big question. I'll address it the best I can. But, right, we work closely with the industries that are impacted by space weather, be that the power grid, be that airlines, be that the satellite industry, GPS. And then there's the industries that you might be surprised to hear are impacted, like the folks that release doves at weddings or pigeon racers. But with the power grid as the example, we work closely with them in a lot of ways. We have a hotline to all the power grid operators to warn them of a storm so they can take protective actions to keep the lights on. That's the sort of thing that, you know, you wouldn't normally see, but is the way we work closely with industry. But also new models. In fact, a new model we released just this year, we call GeoElectric, will take the data from the SWIFT-OL-1 satellite that El-Sayed mentioned. That goes into a model called Geospace that tries to predict the magnetic field variations around the globe. And then the geoelectric model from that predicts the geoelectric impacts that would feed directly into the power grid. So a power grid operator can then model exactly what the response of their system would be to a given storm and put in the protective systems or take the necessary action to keep the lights on. Similarly, with the aviation industry, in fact, there's a brand new service that was begun last year, although we've been serving the aviation industry for decades, organized by the International Civil Aviation Organization, or ICAO. And there's about to be four global centers, of which the Space Weather Prediction Center is one, that issues warnings and alerts to the entire aviation community. So there's knowledge of areas where GPS will be a problem, where communication will be a problem. So, yes, we work directly with the industries, not so much with, you know, the average person on the street, although, of course, I like to tell people here in Colorado, if you can see the aurora overhead, then there's probably some problems happening that you can't even see.
Great. What would be an example, Doug, of, say, a highly active year, like a 200? What would be an event that people could relate to? Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Well, that's a problem. So I'm going
to
throw a couple of years at you. The problem is they're all kind of old. July of 2012, we had an epic storm erupt from the sun that missed the Earth. And so, you know, be thankful that happened, I guess.
Yeah, right.
But the reason I bring that up is, we're saying cycle 25 is going to be like cycle 24 in terms of sunspots. Cycle 24 managed to produce an epic sort of 100-year kind of solar storm, but it missed the Earth. And that's like hurricanes, right? We've had a lot of hurricanes this season. Most of them haven't made landfall, thankfully. But the few that do really matter. And so making that determination, predicting it, warning industry of what's going to happen, that's what we're here for.
So thank you, Susan. We're going to ask you to send an email. We already got your email address, and we're sending you a note
great.
So we can start that conversation. But I'll pass back to Bridget for the next person.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry, thank you. Our next response will be from Leo Enright of Irish Television. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. And I have to say, most of my question, I think, has just been answered. So my thanks to the previous questioner. But I really do hope that maybe you could give me some idea of what way the agencies are thinking now that large corporations have been, for instance, here in Dublin, we're seeing corporations cancel huge real estate deals because they think all their employees are going to be working from home. This is happening globally. So people are going to the hills with their laptops. And I wonder to what extent you have looked at the possibility of a Carrington event and what advice you would give to a society that has instantaneously moved to this distributed system of working?
Well, okay, so thank you. And by the way, I do want to shout out that, you know, Space Weather is a global enterprise, and we coordinate forecasts and talk constantly with forecast centers in other countries, including the UK Met Office, which I realize isn't quite Ireland, but close. The issue for anybody, whether I'm working from home or I'm working in an office, is still going to be about are the communication satellites continuing to operate, and do I have power? And those don't change no matter where I'm working. So I don't know that we need to do anything special from the space weather side, or in changing the way that we work with industry to ensure that those things are continue to be available.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, all. This is Karen. We do have room for one or two more questions if you want to jump in. But before we do that, I just wanted to address a couple of things. We, again, imagery and some press, B-roll, et cetera, is available at nasa.gov/live. You will also see there a link to a written release with more information, but I point to that additionally because there are many links within that release to all sorts of wonderful context, including some of the solar cycle indicators, and that was a question that has come up a few times today. So do look around in there for other information. You are more than welcome to contact any of us with questions to set up additional interviews, and there will be a recording of all of this available. It takes about an hour for us to get it, but if you send us a note, we will get you a copy of that. I do see a few more questions coming in, so I will pass back to Bridget.
Thank you. Our next response will be from Monica Young of Sky and Telescope. Your line is open.
Thank you. Yeah, you've actually already answered most of my questions, but I did have more of a minor question, I guess. It's just about, you were talking about now casting and just being able to predict the space weather and have, like, instantaneous reactions from satellites and such. And so I'm just wondering, how do the solar cycle predictions kind of play into those more practical applications? You know, are there changes that people make based off of these predictions?
So I think a few of us on this call could probably address that question. You know, I'll just say that lots of industries, from the power grid to, of course, the satellite industry especially, but also, as Jake mentioned, and I know Jake had to actually leave around this time, so, you know, planning for that is fairly specific for these industries. You know, one thing we know about transformers is that they build up damage over time. So they may not fail in a particular storm, but increased activity will mean, on average, they're going to have to replace more transformers. So there's you know, lots of maybe little ways that many industries take the information about this to do their planning. And one we talked with recently is the Orbital Debris Program at NASA, who is interested in not only what the next 10 years would look like, but they're actually interested in orbital debris 50 to 100 years in the future. And, you know, a small solar cycle unfortunately means we're not going to be clearing out a lot of the orbital debris that a big solar cycle would take care of.
And I relate to that, Doug, in that I think the aviation sector, both crew and passengers and electronics of airplanes, become more susceptible during solar minimum, because as I had mentioned before, you know, a weak solar cycle means a weaker solar magnetic field, which allows the penetration of really high energy cosmic rays, we call them galactic cosmic rays, that are actually born in the supernovae of stars, and they are not part of solar system, but they get into the solar system, and then they impact our planetary environment. And a lot of these galactic cosmic rays then produce secondary particle shower that can increase, you know, radiation in high altitude aircraft and impact on electronics. So even during solar minimum, there are areas that actually we need to watch out for.
Thank you. Our final question today will come from Kenneth Chang of New York Times. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. This is for Jake Leacher. The Artemis moon landings are currently scheduled to occur basically at the height of solar maximum. I was wondering, are there any changes to the design of Orion, the Gateway, or the landers to take this into account?
Sadly, Ken, Jake had to leave 2 minutes early, and he dropped off just before your question. But if you, I'll send you an email, and we'll get you the answer to your question, okay?
Great. Thanks.
With that, I think we are wrapping up. There were one or two other people who had hoped to ask a question. We're going to follow up with you all in an email. You'll see a note from us. But thank you so much for being here. Really, what I'm doing and NOAA is doing and the other agencies were. And if you have follow-up questions, please feel free to contact any of the names you see at the bottom of the release, including me, Karen Fox, and our NOAA folks, as well as the Royal Observatory in Belgium, who helped track all these sunspots. So look forward to talking to you more, and please contact us if you have other questions. Thank you so much.
We thank you all for your participation in today's conference. That will conclude the call. You may now disconnect. Thank you.